are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 14th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Marcy Wheeler, journalist, proprietor of EmptyWheel.net, on Matt Whitaker. And Donald Trump's what could be soon to be failed attempt to shield his kids from indictment. Also on the program today, White House, imploding's a strong word, as Melania champions the Iran deal. Well, maybe not quite.
Finally, she did one thing.
Not exactly.
But borderline props.
And speaking of finally, someone lends a helping hand to Amazon, New York, to give it $1.7 billion worth of tax breaks and incentives. And as recounts continue in Florida, Republicans keep losing House seats across the country. Final Democratic tally could net 40 House seats and over 300 statewide flips. Meanwhile, Democrats...
Pretty blue. Looking pretty blue.
Yes, Democrats unified in fighting the Republicans' attempt at quashing the War Powers Act's use to curb the Yemen fight. Meanwhile, corporate Dems fall flat on their latest AOC attack. And top census scientist blows the alibi on the anti-immigrant census questions. Meanwhile, top climate change scientist had a slight computation error in the acceleration of the warming of the seas, but we're not out of the woods yet.
No.
As 48 dead in California, wildfires continue to rage. And lastly, hate crimes rose big time last year. Bigly. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, today we have an interview that I pre-taped with Marcy Wheeler about 36 hours ago. And there is one update. And it's interesting. I want to go back and find out her take on this. And maybe I'll give you an update after the interview. But during the course of the interview, one of the things that comes up is a meeting by some key players in the Trump administration, players whom I had speculated, many others had speculated. Usually when I speculate, it's based upon readings of other people's speculation. I should tell you that. And there was concern about the people who were in succession to Jeff Sessions, including the Solicitor General, other individuals in the Trump administration. And according to Marcy Wheeler, turns out these people are not quite as horrid as we may have anticipated, but that's still unclear. Part of that was based upon a presumption that she had that the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice, the OLC being essentially the administration's legal advice as to what is legal within the context of the executive branch and how government works. Not so much, you know, Donald Trump's lawyer, but rather the president has the powers to torture if, you know, John Woo is working there. The OLC has just come out with a memo saying that Whitaker's hiring, or I should say hiring as acting attorney general, is legal. There is a suit that has been filed in Maryland right now to fight that. But nevertheless, I just wanted to give you that update. The OLC's ruling is less relevant because there's already a suit in some respects, because it's going to be tried in court. The OLC, had they come out and said it is not legal, that would have basically made it much harder to maintain, for the administration to maintain the premise that his hiring was legal. But Marcy Wheeler will get into this much more in just a moment. Want to remind you folks, this is actually good. I took this home and I've tried it out, and it's already become a source of a bit of a fight between Saul and I. There is no need to suffer through another sleepless night. Now, as I've mentioned, I have problems sleeping. And Calming Comfort, it's a blanket by Sharper Image, is the luxurious weighted blanket that helps you relax so you can fall asleep and stay asleep naturally. Have you ever had one of these? A weighted blanket?
I haven't, but it sounds very appealing.
Well, you know, the big thing that people in bedding now have are comforters, and they generally tend to be pretty light.
Right.
But you forget. You get a nice heavy blanket on you. It makes you go to sleep. Now, this is what I like to do. I like to keep the windows open, and I like to let it be a little bit cold.
I do as well.
To put a blanket on.
Yes.
Well, Saul likes that too. We now have a fight over the blanket. It's designed with high density comfort fill.
Do you muscle him out of it? I mean, that's a little bit of an unfair fight.
No, he screams. Yes, I can beat him up.
He screams, yes. So he wins. Okay, good.
To provide exactly the right amount of weight to help relax your body, it mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged and helps the production of serotonin and melatonin. That's the thing. Saul does not like it when I hug him. He's like, "Don't, you're crowding me," he says. So you can sleep better, feel great, stress less. Plus, made with super soft velveteen material, Calming Comfort is 100% machine washable, dryer safe. Basically what happened is I got the blanket. I've been using it the past couple of nights. I don't need to get too specific about the arrangement that Nikki and I have, but it's a 2255. And people who are divorced may know what that is. And Saul will climb into bed with me, you know, two or three times over the 5 days I'm there. First day he does, he comes in, he likes this blanket. Next night, can I use this blanket? Then the fights begin. Nevertheless, maybe the answer is you get two. But I'm not getting him his own blanket. He's a kid. He can deal with it.
The father-son rivalry.
Exactly.
Already in action.
The Calming Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image right now. Just for listeners of the Majority Report, you can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com. That's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Get 15% off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY. And because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep, go online now. calmingcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY for your special discount today. So yesterday it was revealed, and Andrew Cuomo, Bill de Blasio, some union reps at a press conference in New York City, that New York had won the lottery. They were splitting it.
Half the lottery.
Yeah, Mega Millions. They were splitting it with a place outside of Washington, D.C. And the details of the plan are essentially that New York is providing at least, and I'm seeing higher numbers, because here's the thing. This is the plan, right? I mean, this is not the exactly the same thing as Foxconn, although the way these things go is generally in the same trend. You make the deal, then the jobs don't quite reach the amount that they're going to be, but the costs get exceeded. I mean, this. Let's just put it this way. The numbers they announced today, I guarantee you, will go in opposite directions. The cost to the city and the state will go up, and the supposed benefits will go down. Because, and we know this, because every single type of incentive deal like this that takes place anywhere, that's the trend that it goes. But even if you are convinced that it's still worth it, I got a buddy of mine who is convinced that it's a good deal.
It's a good deal. We make deals.
He's in tech, and I have no doubt that this will increase the size of the tech industry in New York. I'm sure it will.
Cool.
The point is at what cost? I mean, even if you think it's a
super
I'm
awesome.
Speaking specifically, but the problem with this is what it does to the broader community. And AOC does not represent Long Island City, as a listener corrected me on. But the implications of it are going to spread out. I mean, this is the way it happens, right? Like, as soon as Long Island City gets priced out, and metropolitan New York has already driven out hundreds of thousands, if not close to a million middle-class folks, because it's just simply too expensive. And this is going to maintain that trajectory. AOC came out and said this is a $1 billion company. The idea that it will receive hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks at a time when our subway is crumbling, our communities need more investment, not less, is extremely concerning to residents here. Yeah, at the very least. But let's be fair. Stuart Varney of Fox Business visited Fox and Friends today to make the substantive case as to why New York City needs this. Now, remember, okay, maybe Amazon would go somewhere else if there was no incentives. And I say maybe because it's quite clear. Amazon needs New York far more than New York needs Amazon. There's a reason why they chose these two places, because they want to be near the seats of power in this country. They don't want to be the primary, they don't want to go to a place where they dominate the scene like they do in Seattle, because it causes too much scrutiny on them.
I really thought Tulsa had a chance.
Well, that's the thing. If you go to a city like that, you're expected to do something for the community. Honestly. And here, nobody's going to be saying, like, where's Amazon contributing? They're going to throw a couple of bones. But this is a trillion-dollar company. Maybe a trillion is a little bit much. But it is, we're talking, this is a company worth billions upon billions of dollars. The idea that they need a subsidy to come here is a joke. But nevertheless, New York does not need Amazon. However, let's hear the argument from the other side. There could be a very substantive argument here as to why we should be investing in Amazon. This is putting aside all the other problems that we might have with Amazon. Any argument I could make about Amazon 3 days ago, I still make, that the company itself is problematic in terms of its size. We had an interview, when was that, Brendan, that we had on from the woman from Portland, Maine?
Last
and what was, yeah, Mitchell, and about Amazon's attempt to become the market, not just dominate a market, but to become the market. But putting all that aside, let's hear the argument as to why it's a good thing here.
The young lady does not understand growth. You got to grow a business. She doesn't understand growing a business. You got to put money in to get money out.
And some of the money. Pause it for 1 second. Now, pause it for 1 second. Now, I don't know what business he's talking about. Amazon, that business is growing, but it's not the business of the state of New York to grow Amazon. All right, Amazon's going to grow anyways. That's a big part of the problem. Now, maybe he's talking about New York State as growing a business. But New York State is not a business. It's a state. And the mission of New York State is not to increase its GDP. The mission of New York State is to help the lives of its citizens.
Yeah, you guys can agree to disagree on that one.
We can agree to disagree. But let's hear Varney's. Come on. This is going to be... Want to be fair and balanced here. Let him have his say.
This is Econ 101.
Here we go.
Understand growing a business. You got to put money in to get money out.
And some of the money does go to infrastructure, right?
Oh, absolutely it does. Infrastructure. I think they're building a new high school.
They're going to build a new school.
A school.
But the price per job is something like $48,000 per job that New York is giving up in tax breaks.
Actually, it's $61,000 per job in New York City, which is a very stiff price. I think it's worth it. Because to bring in a company like that, with all that money and jobs...
How can you say no to a company like that?
Are you going to say no? Go someplace else?
So if they're giving up $60,000 per employee, what does the average employee make there?
I don't know. I simply don't know. What kind of employees they're going to be? I don't know the answer.
I do know this.
So that's the argument. Don't know the details. Just know, like, what are you going to do? Say, go somewhere else?
I minored in economics at Bates, and I hated the numbers, but I did end up acing my finals with a... The where are you going to do? Go somewhere else argument?
You're going to let them go somewhere else? How much is that going to cost? I don't know.
Like, you understand economics very well, young man.
It's expensive, yes.
But... I also like how he basically is making all these Keynesian arguments all of a sudden. Because it's like, well, wait a second. All of a sudden, we aren't worrying about spending and we're not being tightwads because you have to spend something to make something. I guess this only applies when you're giving corporate welfare.
Here's the point. If New York State is capable of providing $50,000, $61,000 per person for a job, why not go out and hire people to do exactly what will benefit New York State?
Build new high schools, fix the subways.
I don't know. Let's just assume for a moment, like, we don't even have ideas as to what that is. Surely there is a commission that could come up with a list of things that the state could do that would increase the happiness and the productivity, if you want, or whatever it is, the value of being a citizen of New York State that would undoubtedly have benefits to other people, but it wouldn't even be a bank shot. How can we benefit people directly? And maybe that is a local state senator who says, let's get rid of all of New Yorkers' student debt. I mean, we know the implications of that in terms of the economic value of that, right? More people buy. The number one reason given by the president of the Home Builders Association in the nation for why there have been the number one inhibitor to building new homes is student debt, according to the president of the Home Builders Association of the United States. I mean, just
there's
as an
too
indication.
Many numbers for this argument. What you should just say is, we should just get rid of student loans. What, are you going to say no to that?
Well, I mean,
it doesn't make any sense.
There are so many other ways to directly benefit New Yorkers if you're going to expend this money. And since we now know that we can expend this money, let's expand it. And if Amazon says, well, then in that case, we're going to go to Boston. Fine. The reason why they want to come to New York is because New York is New York. And I think in Boston, I would suggest that they also don't offer them that kind of money.
Yeah.
But That's, I mean, ultimately.
And then Bezos will put on his secret bionic suit he's been working on and just start taking out cities.
Right.
I mean, this is where this is going. I mean, if you look at his steroid regimen, this is a very disturbing time and trend.
We've all seen what happens with Lex Luthor.
I'm not an accelerationist, but.
But I am. If,
I mean, I feel like we have no choice. We're all riding the wave right now. And if giving up basic public services to build a helipad for the richest man in the world brings on the rev, increases class consciousness, silver linings.
Well, and just so that people know what you're talking about, apparently there's they're going to build a helipad and he gets 100 essentially like passes of
where
he can do over 100 of where he can do his helicopter flights in. I mean,
De Blasio is a tough negotiator.
But I mean, look, listen. It's easy to poo-poo. It's easy to poo-poo that. But think of how much work that means. You're going to be hiring one more guy who's going to be at the helipad full time.
Velocity of money.
And then there's all the arguments as to why Amazon is problematic. Period.
What are you going to do, say no to them?
So, you know, it is a problematic thing to do if you don't care about monopolies and the implications of Amazon, you know, nationally and as an entity. But then it's a problematic thing to do from the perspective of just being like a mayor or a governor of a city or a state.
Hopefully Bill de Blasio will be listening to this podcast in one of his commutes from the Upper East Side to go walk on a treadmill in Park Slope.
There you go. Folks, speaking of health, nice segue, Michael. One of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth. Yet most of us can't do it properly. I swear to God, this is completely impromptu. Now, today, as we said, we had a Quip ad. Michael literally said like, oh, Quip.
This is not even a joke.
It's weird.
I'm shocked at how good this toothbrush is. It literally forces you to speak like ad copy in real life.
Quip is a better electric toothbrush. It's created by dentists and designers. Quip was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even enjoyable. With sensitive sonic vibrations, it's gentle on your sensitive gums. My dentist, I had a deep cleaning last Thursday, where they shot me full up of Novocaine. And the dentist was like, just take it, put it on the angle. I said, I got the Quip. She's like, good. That's the best kind. That kind of the vibrating kind. The built-in two-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides and guide you to a full and even clean. What we got to do is come up with maybe a Quip where I am singing the ABCs. Because that's what I do for Saul.
That's a good idea.
Better yet, Quip doesn't require a clunky charger. Instead, it runs for 3 months on one charge, and it comes with a multi-use cover that mounts to your mirror for a less cluttered sink space. No wonder Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association. Folks, you know why I love my Quip. I'm like slowly everyone around me is going to have a Quip. Everyone
around me. I've already bought a Quip for somebody.
You did?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. Well, I'm also very supportive of people's oral hygiene.
Who might that be?
Oh, my dad.
Okay.
I've heard that up, sure.
That sounds like a story. Folks.
I know how you use
You will love Quip as much, apparently, as we do in the office. It's getting weird. They are backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip, getquip.com/majority. You know what? I mean, I gave a Quip to my sister for, I don't know if it was Hanukkah last year. It's not the most, you know, sort of like luxurious, but it is a really practical thing that she is super, super psyched that I got her. Super, super psyched. And you can buy, you know, like a year's worth of refills in advance. You get the first one free. Check it out, getquip.com Patreon.com/majority. All right, quick break and right back with this pre-recorded interview, Marcy Wheeler. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Marcy Wheeler. She is the proprietor of EmptyWheel.net. Marcy, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be on.
So on October 30th, you wrote a piece in the New Republic entitled, If Trump Fires Mueller, anticipating that perhaps after the election, we may see some action on that front, and we did, but it started with Jeff Sessions. Let's start with that. But what is the top line that we should be aware of at this point following the election in regards to Trump and Trump Inc., I guess, in terms of their legal jeopardy?
We don't know. And I don't think we'll know for about a week or so about what happens with Mueller. And it may be within that week that we actually learn a lot more about what kind of legal jeopardy Trump is in.
So this is going to be a busy week.
Maybe Mueller will get fired and we'll all go to the beach or something.
Right. Okay. Well, all right. Let's start with this then. Let's walk through the firing, because I think the piece that I think is most instructive of yours, at least for the moment, the most comprehensive, is the question: did Ebbett Flood mean to create a legal morass, or is he off his game? So Ebbett Flood was, by your reckoning, one of the few competents that Donald Trump brought on board. He was. He helped Cheney deal with the special counsel in Congress back in the day. He's a longtime Washington, I guess, lawyer defending politicians in various things. I think he was involved in maybe even Clinton's impeachment.
Yep.
So let's start with this question of what is the relevance of whether Jeff Sessions was fired or resigned, and when?
Okay, so really quickly to go over what happened is, starting at 11:30 the day after the election, Trump gave a press conference, lied about how well the Republicans had done. When that was going on, Trump had already had John Kelly call Sessions and say, "We want your resignation." Sessions said, "Can I have until the end of the week?" Kelly called back later and said, "Nope, we want it today." And he replaced Sessions with his chief of staff, a guy by the name of Matt Whitaker. And Whitaker, on paper, is sort of qualified. He was U.S. attorney for one of the districts in Iowa under Bush. So, yeah, he's a lawyer at least, which, you know, you might not get that from Trump.
Right.
But he's really a hack. I mean, he's kind of the quintessential Republican hack. He spent much of 2017 saying, here's how to get rid of the Mueller probe. He was interviewed that summer for a job as part of Trump's White House counsel defense team. And then in the fall, he didn't get the White House counsel job. He was made Jeff Sessions' chief of staff. Sessions' chief of staff was given a big promotion, creating an opportunity there. The White House forced Sessions to hire this guy, Whitaker. And so he has been a senior DOJ official for a year. And under some interpretations of the law, that means that if Sessions resigns, you can replace him with somebody of sufficient seniority in a temporary appointment. And that's what the government, that's what Trump claims happened. Now, it's it's clear that Sessions was forced to resign. He made that clear in the first line of his letter. And the Democrats in the House
I would just be clear on that. In the first line of his letter, he said, "You've asked my resignation. Here it is." Right? It was something to that effect.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing.
Right.
But he made it clear that he didn't offer this except for upon the, at the very least, the insistence or the request. And there may be no difference, right, when you're talking about the president, that he resigned.
Right. And also, frankly, you know, if Kelly says, "Can we have your resignation?" He says, "Friday, you can have it." And Kelly says, "No, we want it today." That seems to me it's a coerced it's an even more coerced resignation. And the Democrats in the House are making it very clear that they believe it was a firing. If he was fired, if Sessions was fired, then Whitaker's appointment is not legal, because you can only have him in place rather than somebody who's Senate confirmed if Sessions resigns. Basically, the idea is the president can't fire somebody to then put in place somebody who was not Senate confirmed. In addition, there are a couple of other questions about whether he would be a legal appointment as well, including from Neil Katyal, who is the guy who wrote the special counsel regulations, and George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband. And they argue that, for one, because you have a Senate-confirmed person right there in the form of Rod Rosenstein, who is the person who would take over if the attorney general were gone or disabled, you got to go with him. You can't go with this hack from Iowa. And you also, there are rules that say you can't do this in DOJ. Katyal has written another piece that says even if his appointment is legal, he can't supervise Mueller, because then you have basically an inferior officer supervising an inferior officer. In other words, there's a bunch of reasons to think that his appointment is not legal and that his supervision of Mueller is not legal. And, you know, everyone's talking about, well, we don't know and we won't be able to decide whether that's true or not unless somebody gets standing and challenges his appointment in court, but that's actually not true. And this is one of the most interesting things from last week. CNN did this great, thus far, like one of the only really good reports on the firing. And it described how as soon as John Kelly called Sessions, he and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who's the guy who overseeing Mueller right now, his principal deputy, who is also involved in overseeing Mueller, and this is really key, the Solicitor General, Noel Francisco, who's the third-ranking DOJ official, assuming Sessions is still there, on that day he was the third-ranking, and then also Stephen Engel, who is in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel, who, again, Senate-confirmed, very senior DOJ official, all of them, with the exception of Rosenstein's deputy, all of them were senior to Whitaker, and they're sitting in the room with Jeff Sessions going, what do we do and how do we protect the Russian investigation? And according to CNN's report, somebody in that room that they don't name said, we don't even know if this is constitutional, just like the rest of us are, except the difference being that in that room, Stephen Engel is the guy who, for DOJ, for the entire executive branch, is the one who decides whether these things are legal. So I at least suspect that those people said, okay, Steve, give us an opinion, give us a memo, and how soon can you have it done? Because if he comes back and says, no, it's not legal under the Vacancies Reform Act, you can't have, you know, you can't appoint Whitaker when Rosenstein's available, then it's not legal, and DOJ is arguing that it's not legal. And one of the things I point out is that Sessions' resignation is not dated, much less timestamped.
Okay. Hold on with Sessions not being dated. I just want to get into that dynamic about the OLC. So the OLC, for people who don't recall, was the agency within the Department of Justice, you know, the sub-agency, I guess, that, let's say, the Bush administration went to and said, we need legal justification to torture. John, you wrote this up and whatnot. If the OLC writes it up, is it necessarily binding? Like, doesn't it still have to go to court at one point? Or is that just a way to basically say the OLC is saying to the Trump administration, like, you have no legal standing. Like, you'll have to come up with a theory on your own because the government doesn't have one as to why it would be legal for you or constitutional, I guess maybe legal because this is under a statute, right, to appoint Whitaker in this instance, right?
They're pointing to an old, they actually are pointing to an old OLC opinion written by Ed Whelan, for those of you who remember Ed Whelan's role in the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation.
Yes.
But it is inexact. It doesn't exactly follow to what we're looking at here. And the only time, you know, that people who know this stuff can think of where you had somebody in charge of DOJ who wasn't confirmed for more than hours was during Watergate, after right. Borg was firing people. And so, it's never happened before. There's no precedent. And, you know, what the White House is saying, well, there's this Ed Whelan opinion, but if Engel is either did or is revisiting the issue, then that poses other legal problems. And it also gives Mueller an opportunity to say, and he's writing a memo about this right now as we speak, by the way, but it gives Mueller an opportunity to say to, say, the D.C. Circuit, oh, DOJ has told me that Whitaker is not a legal appointee, and therefore I'm still reporting to the person who, in the absence of an attorney general, in the absence of an attorney general who can do this, I'm still reporting to the guy that I'm supposed to be reporting to, which is Rod Rosenstein. And so this is one of the reasons I say we don't know what is going to happen. I just have a hunch that something like this is going on. And then there are the other questions about, even if Whitaker was legally appointed, he's got all these conflicts. He's run a political campaign for one of the grand jury witnesses. He had all these statements before he was appointed, both attacking the Mueller investigation, but also saying, oh, sure, everyone would take the same meeting that Don Jr. took.
Right.
And he, as I said, and he was interviewed to be part of Trump's defense team. So that is also problematic.
So there's all sorts of conflicts, not the least of which he was part of a company, I guess, that was investigated by the FBI. You sort of didn't mention
still being
that.
Investigated, as far as we know.
Yeah, you know,
still being
things,
investigated.
Sometimes these things slip the mind, Marcy, and you forget about those things. But the real the long and short of it is, at the very least, regardless of how these questions would be answered, what they do provide is a grounds in which Mueller would contest any actions that Whitaker would take that would slow roll his investigation, that would defund his investigation, that would do anything else, because he would then go, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just trying to understand how sort of this practically goes forward. He would then go to the D.C. Circuit and I guess to a panel of three judges and say, you know, please enjoin him from doing this because A, all of the things that are sort of public that we know about make his hiring invalid. And B, there's also, and there may be, this is hypothetical, an OLC memo that suggests that his hiring's not valid, that he's not really the guy. So, I mean, is that how it would work? That's how it would play out if it goes down that route?
Yeah, and it may not go down that route. I mean, it may be that on Thursday, Rosenstein said, you guys blew the resignation and we have until Friday to put stuff in place. It may be that Mueller already has indictments sitting, waiting to be unsealed, and he's just kind of finishing with Jerome Corsi, among all people. It may be that, you know, so there are a bunch of possibilities. We, you know, obviously Mueller's not telling. We'll find a couple of hints. As I said, he's writing a brief due on Monday, a week from today, in a subpoena challenge of somebody close to Roger Stone. And that subpoena challenge was heard. The hearing was heard last Thursday, and there were some interesting things that Michael Dreeben, who works for the Solicitor General, that he said. He basically said, well, we can indict somebody on our own. We can, you know, give somebody immunity on our own. We can do a plea agreement on our own. We can't subpoena a journalist on our own. So, you know, he was sort of laying out what he thought they could do without going to their superior, which may be Whitaker, maybe Rosenstein still, we don't know. And that by itself was interesting, but the judges on that panel said, you know, they started that hearing by saying, let's pretend that what happened yesterday didn't happen, and then we're going to ask you to give us more briefing on what you think what did happen yesterday has an impact on this challenge. And so we'll learn on Monday, if not before, what Mueller thinks his legal status is and how Whitaker's appointment changed it. So, you know, we may not know until then, but we should learn on Monday.
Okay, so just to be clear, we are pre-taping this on Monday the 12th. Between now and then, there could be, you know, Mueller will have a better sense of his status. It's quite possible that by, you know, midway through this week, because of the nature in which they solicited Sessions' resignation, that the statute in which they're operating under, which applies if a guy like Sessions actually resigns rather than is forced to resign, nullifies Whitaker's appointment and makes it too susceptible to legal challenges. So they have to basically do a do-over or just give up the ghost on this plan. You mentioned the idea of Mueller already having indictments. Will you walk us through that, like, you know, like it's almost a fail-safe type of mechanism, at least to the extent that it exists. We don't know that it does, but that Mueller sort of may have anticipated a day like today, or probably did. And
he certainly did. Yeah.
Right. So what does that mean? There are sealed indictments. Just walk us through what would have happened up to this point if today there are X number of sealed indictments. Who would they be sitting with? Who could unseal them? Who could stop them from being unsealed, if anybody?
So we don't know whether this happened or not. And there's a lot of hoax, you know, there's a lot of rumors on the internet claiming there are, you know, 100 sealed indictments. I would distrust that. But it is, in fact, true that, I mean, obviously Mueller anticipated something like this might happen. The Friday before Election Day, he was really pressuring to get some witnesses against Roger Stone on the record. So just for example, it's possible he finished an indictment against Stone, had the grand jury vote to approve it, and then left it sealed. And if that's the case, once the indictment, as far as I understand it, once the indictment is done and sealed, then it no longer belongs to DOJ. It belongs to the court, and in this case, it would belong to the judge overseeing the grand jury, which is the chief judge in D.C. Her name is Beryl Howell, Obama appointee. She has been totally by the book, and I can envision her being, you know, the next incarnation of John Sirica. So it would be up to her. And you know, Mueller could go and ask to have it unsealed. One of the interesting things that happened, there's been a lot of talk about how Mueller sent parts of the investigation to other places, most notably the Michael Cohen hush payment stuff to Manhattan, basically. And that's a really independent U.S. Attorney's Office, and that's going to be as hard to fiddle with as fiddling with Mueller is, just because that's the culture of SDNY. So that's one way that we know he protected parts of his investigation. We know that Trump is being investigated in that. Trump committed campaign violations in that case. Wall Street Journal reported that the other day. The other thing that he did is three of his team members have already been spun back to their home departments. They're just there as protected employees of DOJ, and it's something Haywire went to go on, and there's good reason to believe that they're continuing to work on related issues, they could then go to the court and say, we want these grand jury materials because they pertain to our day job. So they could free them, you know, once the Democrats take over in the House. If things went really haywire, they could try and go get those grand jury materials. So there are ways to get that.
Let me just recap, yeah, though, so that people aren't lost, because there's a lot of information there. So, okay, so we don't know how many indictments Mueller has. We know that there's, I mean, it's been reported that there's at least one or two.
If any.
Hasn't there been reports that there's at least one sealed indictment, maybe from a couple of months ago? I mean, is it possible that he would have, but let's just assume that we don't know. It could be anywhere from zero to, I don't know, whatever number. Let's just pick a number, 25 indictments.
Yeah, I want to emphasize it could be zero, though.
Okay.
I really want to emphasize that.
So it could be zero, but if there were anything more than zero, they would be with the judge. You mentioned Soraka. I didn't know how to pronounce his name, but this was just recently revealed that there was basically a plan. Is that who you're referring to, the judge from the Watergate case?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and these were recently released by a... I guess it was a FOIA. I want to ask you what you think about the timing of that. But just to cover where we just covered, so these indictments are there, and they could be unsealed if Mueller was fired tomorrow by hook or crook. You're suggesting that people from his team who have been re-embedded back in the DOJ could go to the judge, and there is basically almost like a thread hanging from there from other stuff that they're doing that would unseal these indictments. Or could Mueller?
Maybe not unseal it, but maybe pick up the prosecution in their home area. So one of the prosecutors who's been spun back is a woman named Kyle Free, and she's a money laundering specialist. So she's back, I think, in New York. And if Mueller was fired tomorrow, could she then pick up bribery and money laundering? Yeah, maybe. And she'd be in New York, and it'd be a lot harder to screw with her. So that's another possibility, is that you've got these team members who know their portfolio. They're part of the portfolio. And even if you fired the entire Mueller team today, they'd still be there with the knowledge and with the ability to free up grand jury materials for further prosecution.
Okay, great. Assuming all of that is there, could Mueller do anything with those things, or is it just up to the judge at that point to say, like, okay, I'm watching this go down, and it's time for me to unseal these indictments?
Well, somebody from DOJ has to ask to have them be unsealed, so, you know, It could be somebody from Mueller's team. Most of Mueller's people are DOJ employees, so they're actually harder to fire, and they could go and say, we need to unseal these indictments. Again, if there are any, and I want to stress that there may not be, that they could then... I mean, basically, somebody has to go to the judge and say, we gave you a good reason to seal these back on November 2nd when we handed them up. Now it's time for us to unseal them. We're going to go arrest these guys. And that's how it would work. But ultimately, it's Beryl Howells. It's the judge. It's her decision to unseal. And it's her decision what happens with the grand jury materials. And that's something that could be litigated forever. But that's something that's kind of the real fail-safe, that if everybody is fired, the House Judiciary Committee is going to come after those materials, and it would be up to Beryl Howell to decide whether or not to share them.
All right, so let's just go down that road for a moment, too. Is it possible that the House Judiciary Committee comes in, whatever, January 22nd or something, they convene their first, they have their staff, and let's say Mueller is fired. Now, could they hire Mueller as a staffer? I mean, what?
They're not going to.
Okay.
They won't. Different committees in the House are going to do different things. Schiff is going to pick up a lot of the threads of the Russian investigation that were dropped under Devin Nunes. So,
right.
You know, you should expect some attention into the finances. You should expect witnesses who avoided testimony like Hope Hicks, she was allowed to not answer all the questions, and she obviously knows a lot about the response to the June 9th meeting, for example. So they'll bring them back, and they'll flesh out certain other areas of the investigation. It goes to the House. I mean, the reason the House Judiciary is important is because if there were an investigation of the president that might turn into impeachment, that goes through the House Judiciary Committee, and they're important. You know, that's where the Watergate precedent is worthwhile. In Watergate, what Jaworski did, what the prosecutor did, was he said, "Okay, here's what I would do if I were going to impeach the president. Can't do that. So let me take the actions that I would impeach him for, put together, basically box up the information, the evidence I have for all of the actions the president took that I would impeach him for, and have the grand jury vote to share that information as a kind of freestanding report that makes no accusations. It just says, here's what the president did, and here's the proof. Have the grand jury vote to be able to share that with the House Judiciary Committee. That's what happened during Watergate, and I would imagine one of Mueller's attorneys actually worked on the Watergate team. I would imagine that Mueller is taking certain lessons from Watergate, and I would imagine that he would at some point, and possibly did before the election, thinking something like this might happen, at some point do something similar, have the grand jury give him permission to share information with House Judiciary if it comes to that. So that's how House Judiciary would get the information. Trump is worse than Nixon. Nixon actually okayed the sharing of that information back in the day. And, you know, Trump, I would imagine, would fight it because Trump is Trump. But, you know, then Brett Kavanaugh will get to decide or something like that. I mean, look, ultimately, some of the arguments that Trump is already making and that the appointment of Whitaker makes is that the judiciary has no role, isn't a third branch of government with its own power to keep people in line and enforce the law. And that's the kind of stuff that pisses off judges and justices, regardless of what party. And the Nixon precedent, I think, is a pretty solid precedent. I don't think, you know, even this court is going to overturn it in substantial fashion. So that's sort of where we could be headed if things go really haywire. But who knows? Maybe Mueller will be able to work out the week. He'll go indict Roger Stone, and then we'll be in business.
The release of that roadmap that you talk about, was that a coincidence? Well, what do you make of the timing of that? I mean, that's quite a coincidence. And that was
it came out right before.
Yeah. I mean, who was it that released it exactly, and what does that tell you about the timing and whatnot?
Okay, one of somebody who was on Nixon's defense team has been trying to get it released for years, and then Ben Wittes and Jack Goldsmith from Lawfare said, "Hey, let's go get it released." I'm not even sure if they knew of the other FOIA, so they tried to get it FOIA'd, but they tried to do it more urgently. And what was released was actually stuff that was already in the public record, but released in the form that it was released in the roadmap. So in other words, there's still redactions in there, but at least it shows us how the roadmap worked, what it looked like. And they did it, Ben and Jack did it, because of the Mueller investigation. So it's not a coincidence. They did it for that reason.
Right.
That said, I'm sure that, I mean, like I said, Mueller has somebody on his team from the Watergate investigation, so he would have that insight if he hasn't already gotten that roadmap. And I know of another key player in this whole process who obtained a copy of the roadmap before it was released in FOIA. So we may not have been able to see it, but at least one of the people who would need to see it had seen it before it was released publicly.
So there was somebody associated with the team who was trying to conform what they were doing to this previously designed roadmap. The notion that it was, I mean, obviously there's been attempts to FOIA this for a long time, as you say. Do you think that the release of it was timed by the releasing body? Was it the archives or was it the DOJ that had to release it? And
I want to correct. I want to make something very clear.
Please.
When I say that somebody else had gotten a copy of the roadmap, I have no idea whether Mueller had seen a copy of the roadmap. There were claims that Ken Starr wanted it and never saw it. All I'm saying is that, and I don't, and I'm not speaking, I'm not saying at all that I know what Mueller's team has done. They have somebody from the Watergate team on their team. So that's where their knowledge would definitely come. I'm saying somebody else, somewhere else in government was able to get a copy, and it's somebody that you and I would be happy had a copy and was thinking in these terms ahead of the game. So that okay. also was happening before the roadmap was released publicly. It was released by the archives. With the approval of Daryl Howell. And this is also probably not a coincidence, but that FOIA case went to the chief judge in D.C., again, Daryl Howell, who is overseeing the Mueller grand jury, and she is, because she's overseeing the Mueller grand jury, she's the one who would decide whether or not a report from the grand jury gets shared with the House Judiciary Committee. So, and she's the one who would like to be able to share the full roadmap. What she did was approve, order basically, the archives to release whatever had already been publicly released, and she's waiting on a D.C. Circuit decision to decide whether or not she can release the rest of it. But
so what does that
do? Where that goes.
Once it's public, I mean, assuming that, you know, there would be some vague awareness of that roadmap at the very least on a Mueller's team, and adding the notion that there's someone that you and I might appreciate was aware of it too, so that they, you know, maybe can you know, provide some other sort of like, what is the were they simply acting on like, okay, here's a FOIA and I'm going to release it? Or what does it do to have that released publicly? Does it just create more pressure of like, create more of a structure to validate any actions going forward that may, that may follow that roadmap?
Well, it's 50 years, 45 years. So it's not, we're not talking about the Mueller roadmap being released tomorrow. We're talking about, we're really, when I say the fail-safe, we're talking about Mueller successfully sharing the results of his grand jury with the House Judiciary Committee, if it comes to that.
Right.
I don't even, you know,
it may not come to
I expect,
that.
Yeah, it may, well, I mean, I expect they'll ask.
Right.
Because I would ask. But there will be a lot more support to do that, if, say, Mueller gets fired, then there's going to be a lot of pressure to make sure that that happens. Whereas if Mueller is still working, they're not going to get anything. And they probably won't ask. And as I said, the committee that's going to do the most investigation on the Russia question right off the bat is going to be Schiff, the House Intelligence Committee, not the Judiciary Committee. So, you know, Judiciary Committee is going to investigate, they're going to investigate Whitaker's appointment. They're going to investigate the investigation into Kavanaugh, the vetting of Kavanaugh. They're going to investigate Trump's use of the pardon power. But they're not going to investigate Russia per se unless something happens to Mueller, in which case they're the ones constitutionally have to.
Okay. And so lastly, Jerome Corsi. Maybe not exactly yeah. lastly. Maybe not exactly lastly. But I should just remind people, Jerome Corsi is the guy who wrote, who basically built the Swift boating of John Kerry, right? He's the one who assembled the Swift boaters, and he's a WorldNet Daily guy. I guess maybe not so different from Roger Stone in that respect, from that sort of same swampy environs. What has he got to do with this?
Yeah. Oh, and don't forget, he's behind the birther.
And he was also the birther guy, too. I mean, he's had a very esteemed career on the right. So what does he have to do with the Mueller investigation?
So Mueller has been interviewing him for 2 months, and he did a broadcast last week where he basically he made it clear that something was going down with the Mueller investigation and said he might not broadcast today, and I don't think he did. So he may be facing an indictment himself. My guess is what's going on is that when Stone first gave excuses for how he knew that Podesta's time in the barrel was coming, he said, well, that has to do with a report that Jerome Corsi did for me in August in the same time period, August 2016. But what's interesting, and I've laid this out, is that Steve Bannon and Rebecca Mercer had a report on August 1st of 2016, so right after the DNC emails drop, where they basically say Hillary is the one with close ties to Russia. It was a crazy report, but they did it. You know, I think it's a really good question why they had it ready on August 1st. They had been working on it since March. But in any case, that's in the background. One of the things they do in that report is attack John Podesta for he served on the board of this company called Juul. And Roger Stone has at times said that's what the time on the barrel comment was. At other times, he was saying that he was talking about Tony Podesta and his ties, we now know, to Manafort, but his ties to the Ukrainians. But what's really interesting, and what I suspect Mueller is after in part, is that on October 6th, so this is the day before the Podesta emails start, after having not touched that Juul attack, the John Podesta has close ties to the Russians, he didn't touch that between August and October. On October 6th, the day before the emails dropped, Jerome Corsi picks that back up again. And then on the 11th, on October 11th, WikiLeaks releases emails that, oh, gosh, have to deal with Juul. And so it's as if, and I think there's good circumstantial evidence anyway, that Corsi and through Corsi or maybe through Stone, that Stone and Corsi learned back in August that WikiLeaks had these emails and expected that they were going to come and waited on their kind of magnification of this Juul attack until the emails came out. And they anticipated that the emails came out, and they were talking about what the emails showed without even pointing to the emails. So my guess is that that's one good way to prove or to at least suggest strongly that Corsi and Stone, sometime in mid-August 2016, learned what WikiLeaks was going to release in October and learned specifically that an attack they had already launched on John Podesta would be not substantiated because these people are conspiracy theorists, right, but would have a tie to something that WikiLeaks was going to release right before the election.
All right. So just so that people understand, you know, Roger Stone basically seemed to predict that something bad was going to happen to John Podesta right before these emails came out. He's trying to pretend like, oh, no, you're mistaken. I wasn't talking about that John Podesta, or I wasn't talking about those emails. I was just saying, like, you know, October is always a tough time for the campaign manager or something, you know, whatever. All right. Well, so what are the implications? If Roger Stone knew about these release of these emails before the public did, is it just that he's lied about it to maybe to the FBI or to the grand jury, or is there something else that implicates?
Well, it depends where they learned it from and what kind of discussions they had about the sequencing of the release of them and the timing. You know, if they were legitimately conspiring, if they were optimizing the release of those emails to fit the attack they wanted to make on John Podesta right before the election, then I think you're getting into conspiracy with the people who hacked and leaked the Democrats. And that's where I think Mueller is going. On top of that, yeah, do I think that, I mean, if that's true, but I don't know that that's true, but, you know, that's my suspicion of one of the things that Mueller is investigating with Stone. Another thing with Stone, by the way, is Stone literally overnight changed his mind about who had done the hack. And he did so basically at almost the exact same time as this attack from Steve Bannon and Rebecca Mercer. So basically August 1st, 2016, he wakes up one day and says, oh, yeah, you know, I believed it was the Russians up until today, but today I've discovered a 400-pound hacker in his mother's basement. And so on August 1st, he changes his mind. He says it's a hacktivist. Which is sort of his cover story now. He was like, yeah, I was talking to Guccifer, but that guy's just a fat hacker in mom's basement. It's not a Russian sitting in Moscow. And so I think there's an interesting story to that. And have no idea what the answer is. But, I suspect that's another area where Mueller is going. And then, on top of that, did Roger Stone lie to the House Intelligence Committee? Did Roger Stone develop an elaborate cover story back in March of 2017? And did Roger Stone threaten Randy Credico to back his cover story at a time when Randy was being subpoenaed? And those are, I think, some of the gravy stories. And I also think this guy Andrew Miller, who's fighting a subpoena, has said, "I know nothing about Guccifer or WikiLeaks," but he did say, he did sort of suggest he might have some legal exposure on campaign finance issues. So it's possible that in the same way that Mueller has charged Manafort with other financial things, same with, Manhattan and SDNY charged Cohen with other things, it's possible that Mueller is going to throw on some campaign finance issues on top of these to make things more difficult for Roger Stone. I don't know.
All right. So, and there was a report the other day that Junior is going around telling people he expects to be indicted. What's your take on that?
Look, I think Junior pretty clearly entered into conspiracy with Russians. And so if Mueller is going to charge, I've argued a quid pro quo conspiracy, the Russians promise dirt and the Trumps promise sanctions relief. And Junior was at the center of that in a number of ways. So Junior is running around saying that he expects to be indicted for lying to Congress, which he probably did. And again, that's House Intelligence testimony, and they're going to, I think, move more aggressively on that in January anyway. But I also think he's at great risk for this conspiracy, and he would be kind of a central player in that conspiracy case. So, if he's indicted, I think that's also where you would go.
Okay. And so lastly, let me just ask you the omnibus question. Is there anything that you think that we should know going into the next week or two where there could be, and maybe this is sort of like make this a two-parter. What should we know, and what is the range of things that we could expect happening over the next week or two as far as, you would guess?
Well, the range of things is Mueller gets fired and Trump believes he has shut down the Mueller investigation to Mueller rolls out indictments, naming, say, Junior and Roger Stone and a bunch of other people. And I think that that's the full range. But I also think, I think the most important thing is we don't know the answers to the most important questions yet. We don't even know whether Whitaker has been briefed on what Mueller is up to. We don't know that. And so without that knowledge, we really don't know what's going to happen. What we do know is, yes, Mueller had every reason to expect something like this would happen. And Mueller has been very good at keeping secrets. So I suspect Trump badly misunderstands how much he could do to undermine Mueller at this point. Somebody who is closer to all of this than I am told me that, he doesn't think you can shut down Mueller. A lot of people don't think you can shut down Mueller at this point. And that may well be true. And even if you shut him down, there are other places where this investigation can crop up. So I guess my big message is people should take what's going on very seriously. I do think it is a constitutional crisis. I do think the appointment of Whitaker was utterly cynical, ham-handed, may well backfire, but a clear indication that Trump will go to great lengths to protect himself. But I will also emphasize that Mueller and Rosenstein have a lot of cards to play, and we haven't seen those cards yet, and we should not enter full panic mode. We should make it very clear that we take this seriously, and I think the Democrats are doing that. But I think it's still a little bit too early to panic.
If Trump does believe, like, okay, the horse is out of the barn, and I got Whitaker in there because he told me he had a plan on how you would starve the investigation and it wouldn't cause any political turmoil because I would just cut his funding and, you know, Mueller's not going to go out there. He's not going to go on Jake Tapper's show and say that my funding's been cut or anything like that. Like, if he realizes, if the Whitaker plan gambit has failed, and it appears like it may have to a certain extent, right? I mean, because now, you know, Whitaker's having to say publicly, I'm not going to cut Mueller's funding. I mean, who knows? He could lie. It's not like it would be hard for him to do that. But, like, does Trump have any moves? He can have Mueller fired, but if he thinks that he can't stop the investigation, what else can he do?
Well, he can start pardoning people.
Right.
I mean, you know, he could, if the witnesses against him, and this, here's another thing that is interesting. Pre-taping on Monday, on Friday is Paul Manafort's first status report. And there was a report from ABC which said Paul Manafort actually isn't cooperating all that nicely. Also sometime this week, I think that the seizures of Manafort's forfeiture start going into effect. We don't get the Trump Tower condo, which is really sad because frankly he doesn't own it. But Manafort is forfeiting $46 million, take out the Trump Tower condo, and that's still $43 million of stuff to the federal government. And once he forfeits that, then, you know, Trump can still pardon him, but, you know, he's still screwed. Like, he still doesn't have the money to pay legal defense. He still will be prosecuted in New York and Virginia and Florida. So Manafort, you know, I said when he took the plea deal that it was not pardonable. Technically, it still was, but things may take place this week that get us much closer to the point where Manafort is not pardonable. And that also is something that Trump may not. I mean, he could pardon Manafort today, right?
But if it doesn't,
there's not going to be.
If it doesn't have material benefit to Manafort, what's the point?
Well, yes, there is limited material benefit, and possibly as soon as tomorrow it will become a lot less material because he'll have lost everything, including the ostrich shirt. Mm. So Manafort is moving forward as well, and that I think makes things more interesting. If that's where Trump is at, the two other people he can pardon to buy their silence are Roger Stone and his son.
Right.
Well, and that may be his last line of defense if, in fact, Mueller is as far as we think as he could be.
And maybe he was sitting I just have a vision of him maybe in the shower in Paris in a ball in the corner. Like one of those really dramatic scenes from a movie where he's like realizing he's starting to run out of moves.
Well, and that's the thing about the Whitaker move is it was really incompetently done because it seems like you could have found somebody who, Alex Azar, who runs HHS, you could have moved him in and not had to deal with all of the problems that Whitaker brings, and he didn't do that. So,
in other words,
they may have.
It shouldn't be that hard for the Trump administration to find someone who has already been confirmed by the Senate who has absolutely no integrity and will do the president's bidding. Right? I mean, that's basically what it comes down to.
Sort of. Although, I mean, Alex Azar is under consideration to be the real AG once Whitaker, you know, hatchet jobs Mueller. But it's also, I mean, one of the other really interesting things about the meeting last week after Sessions was told he was going to resign. In that meeting, I said this already, Rosenstein, his deputy, the guy who decides whether or not the appointment was legal, and Noel Francisco. Now, he's the Solicitor General. I said he's number three in office. First of all, one sort of would suspect that if something really haywire happened, all those people would resign, which would be a big deal. But the other thing is, remember when we were like, okay, he's going to fire Rosenstein?
Right.
And then the next in line will supervise Mueller?
The next in line is
Francisco.
Right. And this was
and so
the Washington
Francisco
Post.
Was in that room figuring out how to protect the Russian investigation. So one of our fears, which is that Francisco would become Mueller's boss, actually probably isn't that big of a fear because he's on Rosenstein's side. He was trying to figure out how to protect the investigation.
So the fact that they chose Whitaker indicates that maybe all those people that we were worried about are not willing to go the extra mile for Donald Trump. And that moment when Rosenstein was fired was based on a Washington Post, or I think it was a New York Times story that told about Rod Rosenstein joking around about wiring somebody to go in to talk to the president. And there's some speculation that Whitaker was the guy who related that story. Maybe he heard that story and then he related it to the Times.
Yeah, I would bet a fair amount of money that he was one of the sources for the Times. Oh. So he tried to get Rosenstein fired in September and then succeeded in getting his own boss fired in November. Had they gotten Rosenstein fired in September, that might have been adequate timing, but Noel Francisco would have been in charge. So, it wouldn't have.
Turns out Noel Francisco is not loyal. Not loyal.
Well, look, I mean, these are lifetime lawyers, right? And they may be, it's like, look at George Conway, Kellyanne's husband, right?
Right.
Do not mistake him for a screaming liberal. But he is a lawyer, and he does believe in the law and the Constitution, and he has made now two arguments about the law and the Constitution that have been very unfavorable to Donald Trump, but that are what you would expect from an honest lawyer, even a conservative, in his position. And maybe that's where Francisco is. Maybe, Francisco doesn't hope for this investigation into Trump, but recognizes that rule of law requires that the investigation proceed in a certain way.
Marcy Wheeler, folks, you cannot do better in any format, medium, temporal, or spatial way of informing yourself about what's going on than to read emptywheel.net. Marcy, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right, folks. That's our interview for today. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will play some audio sounds and some video and take your phone calls and answer your IMs. Let's put this up, though. Right now, I think I said at the beginning of the program, the Democrats have picked up a net of, what did we say, 33? And it is quite possible. They're still counting in California and in Georgia, one or two other places, that at the end of the final tally, there will be 40 plus, or I should say, a net gain of 40 House members in the Democratic caucus. Yesterday, Josh Harder beat Jeff Denham in the San Joaquin Valley in California. There are two other Republican seats that the counting seems to be going against them. One is in Orange County. This is California 45, Katie Porter. I want to just speak briefly about Katie Porter. I don't want my comments yesterday to be misconstrued. And David Dayen had a very good thread on this, and specifically a piece that he wrote about Katie Porter's role in making California responsible for something like 40% of all recoupments on bad mortgage shenanigans, mortgages that had no underlying documentation as to the debt owed and the securitization, the lien against the house. And she was personally responsible for helping out thousands of homeowners as a basically working for out of Kamala Harris's office. And Dayen spent a lot of time, obviously, probably certainly most, and wrote a great book on it, Chain of Title. on that aspect of the mortgage crisis. So despite the fact that she sort of ran to the middle, she was doing so in Orange County, which is a I don't know if they've had a Democratic representative there in decades, but nevertheless. And so so far we have images of the members elect. Now, Republicans, I think they flipped two or three seats. And then, of course, there was also some retirements and whatnot. So there are about, let's see, one, two, three. Let's say, I don't know, about 25, 30 Republican members elect there. You can see the pictures of them all. There is one woman amongst them and one guy, that guy who was on Saturday Night Live, who has an eye patch.
Is that guy. Eye patch guy?
Yeah.
Crenshaw. Eye patch vet.
Now, eye patch guy. I bring that up not because I'm mocking his eye patch, but I'm looking for...
Careful.
I'm looking for some measure of diversity. We have one woman out of those 35 or some odd people, and one guy with an eye patch. And then, you know, to be fair, there's at least two guys who seem to be completely bald, and then a lot of guys with receding hairlines. And then, and also to be fair, there's at least two or three guys who have facial hair.
Are some guys not wearing suits?
So there are two people, three people, four people not wearing suits. So there's a lot of diversity there. You have a lot of
eye
these
patch
men.
Guy coming through.
You have all these white men. Some have some are balding. A couple wearing glasses.
Some are pirates.
One has an eye patch, and one of those white people is a woman. Let's go down and take a look at the Democratic members.
I think
no, the eye patch.
That was a good night. You meant yeah. One of them's a pirate. I mean, the Trump voice. Come on, that was good. Pirate.
And then you look at the Democratic members elect, and it is just it's like a completely different place.
Scary.
We have multiple African American folks. We have. Folks who are...
I see at least four people that might blow up the new Congress in a suicide bombing.
Yes, there is a Muslim
exactly.
A woman. And there
Mike, she's going to hug you and detonate her vest.
Is the woman from Minnesota Ethiopian or Eritrean? I think
no,
Ethiopian.
No, neither. She's Somali.
Oh, Somali. And then we have... I mean, we have men and women. I think the predominant are women. It is pretty striking that those two...
Not a single eye patch.
Now, so
not
you
one.
Look at this, and I ask you, which party is based on identity politics? Like, what is the identity of the Democratic members-elect?
I can.
What is the one identity that you can state about that?
They all make me want to cross the street.
No. All right. To be fair,
I got
to
watch my wallet.
No eye patches.
I just said that. No eye patches. Not a single
no
representation.
Pirates.
So why is this party so bigoted towards
pirates?
Scroll
back up to the Republicans. I mean, this is, you know, like whenever you hear someone say that Democrats are about identity politics. Look at this and tell me which party is about an identity. It's just absurd. It is an absurd talking point. In fact, the talking point itself refutes the talking point. There is no identity.
Identity.
That can encompass... The Democratic, at least incoming members of
Here's
Congress.
Here's one. One might mug you. One might suicide bomb you. How about that?
That's two.
What do you have against vets?
What do you have? Why do you hate vets? That's my question.
There you go. I think there's some vets in the Democratic.
Vets who love America but don't hate America.
I guess this speaks to the bad things about the both sides argument, right? Because they both do identity politics to some degree, but the Republican version is like everyone should be white And the Democrat version is not everyone needs to be white.
Well, the reality is everyone does and everywhere does identity politics in some fashion or another. Right. And but the reality is when you look at this, there is, I mean, to the extent that I even know what identity politics means, right, that you take your cues and you vote based upon, you know, I guess what the identity of a certain person is. There's no consistency amongst the Democratic Party, right? Like there's, it's clear that there is not, there can't be a defining characteristic of an identity that is the catalyst for your vote.
I could give you a defining characteristic. None of these people could get an apartment in any of my buildings.
Well,
how about that?
Well, there's the white guy could.
Well, it's probably good.
I don't know. We'll see who he associates with.
All right. So just wanted to put that up.
Whoa, he has an eye patch.
The other,
he's with us. That's bad luck.
The other, we'll talk more about this in the fun half about the Republicans are now, Ro Khanna has a War Powers Act resolution bill that has been submitted. It is a privileged resolution because of the nature of the War Powers Act. The Republicans are attempting to vote to make it unprivileged, basically to defang the War Powers Act so that they don't have to take a vote on Yemen. And we will talk more about that. The Democratic Party, more or less, I mean, I imagine there's some that aren't, but the leadership certainly is unified in this. We will take a quick break, head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. It's going to have to be a short one today, but we will have it nevertheless. Oh, just a reminder, quick plugs, everybody, today. You can become a member of the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Last night was TMBS.
Malaika Jabali, The Color of Economic Anxiety, and a deep dive into Amazon voter suppression on Friday. ContraPoint, get your tickets to the Bell House show. And don't forget what I IM'd you, Sam.
Oh, right. Thank you.
So this week on the Antifada, we still have our episode out with Jay Firestone, who infiltrated the alt-right in New York. We also have an episode forthcoming about the Greek debt crisis, as well as a bonus about some good riot stories from Greece. Also, Sean is recording an episode of Pod Damn America today, where he does a history of the IWW, and that should be out tomorrow, so check it out.
Literary Hangover, Catherine Maria Sedgwick. More and more people are talking about her because of the episode we did this week, bringing her back, bringing her novel back. Hope Leslie, about the Pequot War and a lot of different things with patriarchy and slavery in Massachusetts colonial times.
Also, don't forget, you can buy tickets to the live Majority Report happening on January 13th, Sunday afternoon, 18 and over at the Brooklyn Podfest at, you go to majority.fm for more information. Folks, don't forget Calming Comfort by Sharper Image. It's the luxurious weighted blanket that mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged. So you can sleep better, feel great, and stress less. The Calming Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. Right now, for Majority Report listeners, go to calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Receive 15% off the displayed price. That's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Promo code MAJORITY, because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep. It's a nice feeling. It's real. It's a nice feeling. Sweetheart, get me a beer. I totally get it. They are. You turn on the TV, some iteration of me. Zero-sum game. It's a nice feeling. Zero-sum game. Zero-sum game. It's a nice feeling. You're going to lose your status. He's the king of his zero-sum game. I totally get it. Zero-sum game. They are. Zero-sum game. Sweetheart, get me a beer. Get me a beer.